You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And Egypt is roiling. And I wanted to get on somebody who really knew the region and really knew what they were talking about. Former ambassador to Mauritania and former foreign service officer to Egypt, Ambassador Edward Peck, is on the line with us. Ambassador Peck, welcome to the program.
A pleasure, Tom.
Thank you for joining us. I'm curious your thoughts on what is going on right now in Egypt and how this fits in the larger frame of the arc of history, the at least the last few centuries of history of that country.
Well, you know, the right now that you started with is the easiest thing because we can all look at it and listen to it and read about it. But the harder part is, you know, where is it going? And I recall back when Mubarak was finally deposed, and he was a man that I knew and worked with, everybody said, yes, it's all over. And I kept saying, no, it's just starting. Given the situation there and the fact that they hadn't had a country that was run by the people for quite a long time, like a very long time, it was difficult to imagine how the people were going to handle it, given all the disparate groups, of gender, of age, of religion, of political orientation. As they thrashed out the future course of the country, there was bound to be a certain amount of dissension and worse as these things were handled. I personally was a little bit interested in the fact that the military, which had really been running the country for about 40 years, was rumored to be prepared to give up its role. Because that doesn't happen much historically. You know, somebody who's been in charge a long time kind of likes to stay in charge. But the army kind of stepped back and let them have a free and fair democratic election, first time for a long time, if ever. And now the people are expressing discontent with the way it's going, which is not unexpected, but the outcome is what's in doubt, which, of course, is what you're asking me. So I can tell you now, without fear of contradiction, that the most difficult thing to predict by far is the future. You can quote me.
Okay, no doubt about that. I mean, all somebody need do is look at American history. We ejected the British, and then we operated under the Articles of Confederation, and then we had kind of a mini-revolution or rebooting with the Constitution, and then two generations later we had a civil war.
Yeah.
And we're still trying to figure out how to make this country work, and
well,
you know, 230 years later.
Yeah, doing a good job of it, but, you know, when you give the people a voice, you got to be prepared to deal with a certain amount of chaos because, I mean, let's just take our country as an illustration where we have blue states and blue counties and red counties, you know, and blue districts and red districts. And we have vast differences between the various parts of our own country, although we've had all this time to make it a little more uniform, a little more unified. Then you take Egypt. They've been at it a long time. Their civilization goes back, you know, 3,000 years of history, recorded history. And they've been through some tough times, and they have some difficult things going on in their neighborhood. And the question has always come down to which religion is the right one and who decides which is the right one, which the world has seen be thrashed out, if you'd excuse that word, in so many different ways in so many different places.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be difficult for them.
Well, it's almost as if, even in contemporary America, if the Canadians were giving hundreds of millions of dollars and weapons to all the blue states, and the Mexican government decided to give hundreds of millions of dollars and lots of weapons to people in the red states, I'm not sure how stable the United States would be. Is this a cautionary tale about our thinking that we can simply step in and say, okay, you guys are the winners, you guys are the losers, and here's some weapons, and here's some money, and we're going to make everything fine?
I think you put your finger on what I consider to be the biggest problem that the United States faces in the world, if not domestically, and that is the combination of ignorance, not the sense of not being smart, but just in the sense of not knowing what the rest of the world is all about, and arrogance, which is the frightening belief that you do know what the rest of the world is all about, and you combine those two with power, and the United States, I think, touts its exceptionalism to the exclusion of understanding that the rest of the people in the world don't necessarily see it our way. The parallel is that people in certain parts of our country don't see what the government is doing as being right, our own, and while people in some other part think it's exactly right.
Mm.
So you cannot, you may quote me on this, I guess there's no need to on the radio, by definition, you cannot impose democracy.
Right.
That's a contradiction in terms.
Yep.
But we're going to try it.
Well, and we've tried it in other places as well, and it hasn't worked out all that well.
Some of them quite recent. And I guess the biggest problem that I faced in thrashing around with my own government is that we have seen so many times what happens when you decapitate a government, whether it was Yugoslavia under Tito or Iraq. Now we're going to do it in Syria, even in what was usually formerly the Soviet Union. If you pull the plug on that kind of a situation, you don't know what's going to happen. But it is not going to be what Americans predicted when we deposed Saddam Hussein, that utopian democracy was going to burst into bloom all over the Middle East.
Ambassador Peck, we just have a minute and a half or so left. I'm curious, in your opinion, who are the major factions that are playing for power in Egypt?
Well, you have the religious factors. You have the Salafists, the Muslim Brotherhood, those who prefer a slightly more secular tone, and that's going to be hard to work out. You have the Copts, the COPTS, standing on the fringes, watching with some trepidation.
They're Christians.
The tide swings back and forth. They're Coptic Christians, I'm sorry. And then you have the outside forces, which are trying to play a role. The worst example of that is Syria, where everybody is meddling, even people from as far away as you can get. So there are so many groups. They are so disparate. So many of them are committed to force rather than rationality and reason. But I fear it's going to be a long time before anything resembling stability returns to Egypt. And I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah. Do you think that one of the major things that is contributing to the social discontent is not so much who's in power, but when Morsi was running for president, he was promising more generous social welfare programs, the equivalent of unemployment and food stamps and Social Security, and he has not delivered on those things?
Yeah, well, not on that, but the economy is in relative ruins. I must admit, and I tell you this with some embarrassment, our Secretary of State made his first overseas visit to Egypt, and in the press conference he came out and he said, and this is a quote as I remember, he said, I told them that they must stop their internal bickering and deal with their serious economic problems. Great idea, John.
Right.
Glad you brought it up.
Right.
Americans don't understand. That's my biggest concern.
Yeah. This really falls into the category of hubris, I think.
Oh, boy. You could call it dynamic hypocrisy.
Yeah. It's absolutely remarkable. Ambassador Edward Peck, former Foreign Service Officer to Egypt, former Ambassador to Mauritania. Sir, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts, insights, and experience with us.
Thank you.
Great talking to you. So what is next for Egypt? What is next for American foreign policy? What is next for the world? And where in the world is Edward Snowden? We'll be back right after this, 15 minutes past this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And neo-Nazi environmentalists who want to protect a nation's resources? Really? I got to tell you about this. Okay, so there's a few things that are just like common sense brain dead. And you wonder why governments don't, specifically actually political parties, why the Democratic and Republican parties don't jump on this kind of stuff. You know, one of them, for example, is our insane trade policy that has shipped tens of millions of jobs overseas. Another is that there, you know, the United States has become the mining pit of the world. We used to import raw materials into this country, make things out of them, and then export manufactured goods. We were the largest importer of raw materials, the largest exporter of manufactured goods in the world when Ronald Reagan came into office. Today, after 33 years of Reaganomics, we are now exactly reversed from that. We are the largest importer of finished goods, and we are exporting raw materials. And many of these mines are owned by foreign corporations, Canadian mining companies, Chinese mining companies, European-owned mining companies own big swaths of the American the fossil fuel industry, if you want to call drilling mining, the precious metals industry, the utilitarian metals, copper mines, iron ore, all those kind of things. In Mongolia, they have a similar situation. Right? The world is mining Mongolia, and the Mongolian oligarchs are getting rich, and everybody else is screwed. And so a neo-Nazi group, Carlos Barria is writing about this over at Raw Story, on Reuters. Raw Story picked up the story, but it's on Reuters. He writes, a Mongolian neo-Nazi group has rebranded itself as an environmentalist organization fighting pollution by foreign-owned mines, seeking legitimacy as they send swastika-wearing members to check mining permits. I'm not making this stuff up. The group is called White Swastika, and they joined several other nationalist groups, White Mongolia, Whole Mongolia, Fire Nation, Blue Mongolia. And they're showing up. I mean, from an office behind a lingerie store in the Mongolian capital, a shaven-headed, jack-booted Sagan Kass, this is the fellow's name, the group's name, stormtroopers, launched bizarre raids on mining projects, demanding paperwork and soil samples to study for contaminants. The group's leader, Erambold Altakum, 40, told Reuters, speaking to a translator, before we used to work in a harsh way, like breaking down doors. But now we have changed. We use other approaches, like demonstrations. They talk about how this the members wore black SS-style uniforms, Nazi uniforms, complete with lightning flashes and replica iron crosses. Today, our goal is to save nature. We are doing things to protect the environment. The development of mining is growing and has become an issue, says the head Nazi. We used to talk about fighting with foreigners, but some time ago we realized that is not efficient. So our purpose changed from fighting foreigners in the streets to fighting the foreign mining companies. Now, I'm not suggesting that the neo-Nazis should adopt this, although I would guess that if you were to do a poll of neo-Nazis in the United States, the majority of them would say, yes, we shouldn't have insane trade policies that send our jobs overseas, and we shouldn't have foreign companies owning our mines and mining our resources and shipping it to their countries for a pittance. This was one of Reagan's biggest contributions. James Watt, his Secretary of the Interior, was selling off Western land that could be mined, for pennies on the dollar. And when he was asked why he was doing something that was so obviously not in the interest of the United States, it was going to lead to horrible pollution for Americans, a lot of profit for foreign companies in foreign countries, he said, well, it doesn't really matter because Jesus is coming again, and when he comes, he will make all things new. Now, I'm not making this up. You can use the DuckDuckGo machine to check it out, or the Google machine or the Bing machine or whatever machine you want. So it's like, when are people going to figure this stuff out? Anyhow, Daryl in Port Orford, Oregon. Daryl, you wanted to talk about the firefighters who died in, was that Arizona? Yeah. Wasn't it?
Yeah, that was in Prescott, Arizona, is the Granite Mountain Hotshots. And I'd like to say first that all my condolences and my heartfelt love goes out to my fire family that's gone there. Yeah. I did this for like 17 years. I started in 91. I've lost a lot of friends to our aggressive stance on fires, when sometimes we should be taking the non-aggressive stance. Because this was straight out, everybody's even saying it on, when you look on Facebook, people are commenting that this was straight out of money, and we're protecting and saving these houses.
Right.
And they knew the high winds were coming in the morning. the forecast, all that that they get. They knew it was coming. They committed these guys anyways. The big thing I wanted to mention to you is there's a company in McMinnville, Oregon, Evergreen Aviation, has the 747s. Mm-hmm. And they are right now not used. He's got 10 used all out of country, and they're having trouble being approved here in the United States.
These and are like tankers to drop flame retardant or drop water?
Yes, they drop fire retardant, the big red stuff that all of us are supposed to avoid. He can drop 10 miles down to his whole load at once, depending on what they need. They didn't have enough aircraft in there, in my opinion, from what I'm reading now.
Because we had outsourced the aircraft?
Yeah, there was. They could have had this guy there quick, and he could have jumped 10,000 gallons. Or it's an incredible amount. I mean, when I got friends that know the guy personally who invented this one.
Yeah.
And it's being held up under government contracts, and they won't let him go in. And it was all over trying to save the houses that were gone anyways.
Yeah.
And I've done it for lots. I know how it feels. I've had to run myself. I've had close calls. I've had to be on top of mountains sitting in 500-acre clearings.
Yeah.
It is the most scariest thing you'll ever deal with. I love my job. That's why I kept it up.
Yeah, yeah. It's a tough one. Daryl, thank you for the insight and for the in memoriam. Good to hear from you, and thanks for watching. We'll be back. It is 28 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. When are politicians going to get it in America? What average working people really want?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I mean, do we have to wait for the rise of the neo-Nazis here? Oh, that's right. They're already rising, aren't they? Welcome back to Talk Media for the rest of us, the Tom Hartman Program. By the way, it's summer. You know, it's like... it's summer. So let's do Anything Goes Summer. Seriously, if there's a topic that you'd like to discuss beyond, you know, I mean, we set this hour up with Egypt, but, you know, it's not so controversial. Mongolian neo-Nazis. If you want to talk about George Zimmerman or Trayvon Martin or America or Edward Snowden, who seems to be lost in limbo. This is very interesting. We'll see where this whole Egyptian... keep in mind, the country is operating without a parliament, without a constitution, and with a president who has taken away from the military and then given to the military and then taken away from the military constitutional powers. He's made constitutional decrees. This is not a mini America. This is a mess. Which is like par for the course. I mean, typically after major changes, you have messes. So, anyhow, Carla in Pueblo, Colorado. Hey, Carla, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am well.
I'm just wondering, why isn't anybody talking about President Bush being out of the country and being arrested for war crimes?
Because he has not gone to countries that have declared him guilty of war crimes.
Oh, well, that's a good answer.
I have a feeling if he was to show up in Spain, he might have a problem. Although that Spanish judge who wanted to arrest him is now leading one of the big human rights organizations. I don't think he's a judge any longer. So we'll see. But I don't think that as much as it would be a fine idea, and as much as he certainly deserves it, at least to have his day in court. I'm not going to convict him without a trial, but I think that George W. Bush certainly deserves a trial. Vince Bugliosi wrote a brilliant book about this called The Trial of George W. Bush for Murder. And he's a prosecutor. He prosecuted Charlie Manson. He wrote a book, Helter Skelter, about that back in the day. And he lays out a prosecutor's brief for a local prosecutor, because states have laws against murder. And what he was suggesting was that any district attorney or any attorney general from any state that has laws against murder, that has somebody who died in Iraq or Afghanistan, they can charge George W. Bush with murder under their own murder laws, murder by deception, murder by whatever. And he lays out the whole process. He was a guest on this program a couple of times. His health is not well right now, so he's not doing media. We've tried to get him back on. But his book is brilliant. So we'll see where that goes, Carla. Thanks for raising the topic. Jenny in American Falls, Idaho. Hey, Jenny, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hi. Thank you. I've been trying to get in for a couple of weeks, and one time you lost my call just as you answered it, so I'm really grateful to talk to you.
Well, thank you for your persistence.
I wanted to bring up the subject of the drones again, because I don't know, and I haven't heard from any source except just looking it up online, but Idaho announced back on April 15th that we had drones in Idaho. And at that time, I was listening to the news, regular local news channel, and it said, don't worry, it's only over the Bureau of Land Management. Well, since then, I found out that on April 3rd, Virginia allowed drones in their state.
Mm-hmm.
And according to what I've been able to research, it was April 15th that Idaho allowed drones in. And there's a bill to protect civilians from surveillance by unmanned, and it's quoted, except in emergencies. And that begins July the 1st, and it said that we need a warrant except over land resources.
Right.
I also got this from...
Did you see the testimony before Congress a week or so ago where the head of the FBI said that we've got drones? I mean, Dianne Feinstein looked shocked.
Oh, I know. No. I saw that, too. But the problem that I'm having, and I'm wondering if any of the... viewers or anyone else knows that the individual states are taking drones in, and they don't report that. I guess because it's a state's issue. But somebody named Chuck Winder on 6/5/13 announced somehow here that we're using unmanned drones for police work in Idaho.
Yeah.
I don't know who that guy is.
My guess is it started out. They're saying public lands, so they're saying we're looking for pot growers. You know, because, like, the war on drugs is you know, they talk about pot being a gateway drug. It is for law enforcement. It's how the military industrial security media complex gets its nose under the tent, you know. So they say, oh, well, you know, there's pot growers and they're growing pot out on the public lands, out in the forest and things. And we need to, you know, fly something over them and figure out what's going on and see if we can find the pot fields. And then, oh, hey, you know, looks like Ralph is up to something bad. Let's just put the drone over his house and look through his windows. And, you know, this is how it goes. This is, you know, how it goes on and on. So, Jenny, I think your concern is legitimate. And thank you very much for the call. I don't know the details, by the way, for these other states. Thank you, Dania. No, thanks. I'm fine. Carol. In Charlestown, New Hampshire. Hey, Carol, welcome to the program. Carol, you have to listen to your telephone instead of your TV. I will put you on hold, and we will check out Dan in Flower Mound, Texas. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I know you're a history guy, and I am too, and I'm always seeming to read books about the Civil War. And I'm right now reading again about the beginning part of the war, and it just strikes me just how similar the South and Texas and kind of the backwoods kind of thinking and getting in the way of meaningful progress. And that time was about the slave issue, but it's like history is repeating itself, and maybe nothing has changed. I mean, those people down there, and unfortunately, I live down here now. This is kind of a backwards, you know, way of thinking a couple hundred years ago, and it's a Tea Party and religion, and I don't know that very much has changed.
I think you may be onto something, Dan. Let's first of all grant that there are no red states. There are, or nor are there blue states. There are purple states, every one of them. That you in the state of Texas, you probably have, you know, a good solid 10 or 20% of your population that's quite progressive. You probably have 30 to 40% of your population that leans Democratic and or would vote Democratic, and probably more than that, probably more like 44 or 45%. And it's just, you know, it's that slim majority that Republicans hold. So we can't just, you know, blanketly condemn everybody. But the Republicans have held that through the centuries in the United States by doing things like denying science. Remember the Scopes monkey trial? And doing things like denying progress. I mean, a large part of the protest of the South against the North leading up to the Civil War was the early stages of the Industrial Revolution. It, you know, for whether it was the cotton gin or whether it was the railroads or whether it was just, you know, the building of factories in the North, not in the South, there was a serious concern about the Industrial Revolution, thinking that it was going to destroy the plantation way of life, and it ultimately did. And so you could say that there was that kind of, anti-progress thinking at that time as well. So I'm with you, Dan.
Well, and even during the last presidential election, I was just sitting there watching the maps, and I saw one map, and they used, red for Romney. And I said, that looks like a map of the Civil War.
Yep.
You know, the same states, the same kind of situation, and the same kind of thinking down here.
Yep.
I've been down here a long time, and it's just like, college education is not such a good thing, unfortunately, let alone in states and the kids.
Yep. My producer, wife, and partner of 40 years, Louise, has been saying for some time, and I've quoted her on the air, she doesn't mind, that Abe Lincoln should have just, when the South seceded, he should have said, okay, see you later. And, we wouldn't have had this bloody war, and the South could have, they could go all red state totally, and people could choose whether they wanted to live in a Koch brothers, libertarian red state paradise, or whether they wanted to live in a Teddy Kennedy blue state, unemployment insurance and healthcare, free healthcare for all, and blue state. I mean, it's just it's pretty straightforward. Should have happened. Anyhow, Dan, thanks for the call. Lewis in Fargo, North Dakota. Hey, Lewis, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom.
Hey. What's up?
I just wanted you to comment a little bit about in the Snowden case, when Snowden was requesting asylum to Ecuador, mm-hmm. and the U.S. said, well, please don't accept any asylum. And then Ecuador, responded, first, the U.S. threatened Ecuador to, if asylum was offered, to resign all the preferential treaties for some products.
For trade, yeah.
Ecuador replied, well, we just resigned it right now, and they are equivalent to $23 million, and we offer those as we offer that to the U.S. as human rights training.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my take on what happened was that that probably WikiLeaks and Julian Assange lobbied the Ecuadorian embassy and Ecuador through their ambassador in the UK pretty hard. They set it up to get Snowden out of Hong Kong and into Moscow. But then Joe Biden called up Correa, President Correa, and said, don't you want to play with the big boys? And Correa started backing off. But I don't know.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, that's just a guess. But that seems to be how it's played out. And now Snowden is stranded in Moscow. Welcome back to the place where we dare ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare say, no, not a chance. Forget it. Jay in Naperville, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, Jay, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I wanted to touch base on what you had said, how the marijuana is the in drug for law enforcement. I wanted to let you know that back in the mid-90s, when I was in the military, we participated in some joint task force missions with six different law enforcement agencies, being U.S. Forest Service, Department of Defense, the Marines, local law enforcement, and so forth. And what we would do is we would go into the U.S. National Forest in upper Northern California
mm-hmm.
Area in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
We would, Black Hawk helicopters, we'd swing down from our ropes, go in there, and we would be looking for marijuana, and that's all it was, marijuana growers.
And wait a second, this is the military invading the United States, our military?
Yes, and Posse Comitatus was made very clear to us. So if we were questioned...
In other words, you may not shoot somebody.
Technically, Yes, we did have order, rules of engagement where we could, if we were shot upon first and so forth.
Wow.
And we, carried, our rules of engagement with us, cards that, spoke about posse comitatus. And the way we got around it basically was that, you know, what's to say if we were just there training and we came across a field of marijuana and I take down some grid coordinates on a GPS unit and I pass this on to the U.S. Forest Service.
Right.
You know,
this is remarkable. Jay, let me just, for our listeners who don't know what you're talking about with regard to posse comitatus, after the Civil War, Congress passed a law called the Posse Comitatus Act that said that never again would the militia of the United States, any part of the American militia, the Army, the Navy, the Marine Corps, the individual state militias, the Civil Patrol, the Civil Guards, never again would they be able to turn their weapons on American citizens. And that law was repealed during the Bush administration as part of the so-called War on Terror. And I believe it got reinstated in one of the NDAAs, and I'm not sure if it's on the books right now or not. But you're talking about a time before Bush repealed it. You're talking about the 90s, right?
Yeah. This was in the mid-90s. It was around 94, 95.
Wow.
And we had been, our unit had been doing this for quite some time. Every year they would pull a few of us, and it was because of our, the brush being so thick and so forth. The growers were using ATVs and horseback. I mean, literally, we would be there. I mean, I would be there at night sometimes, and you're watching people in campgrounds and so forth because you don't want them to, know you're there. And,
So if you're using a public park campground, you might be being observed by the U.S. military as part of their routine surveillance looking for pot growers.
Yes.
Wow.
Especially in California. And that's what I was going to say. So I wouldn't be surprised if drones are already at this point being used, because what's to say the pilot isn't training on how to fly the drone, and when he's training, he happens to see a field of pot.
Right. This is why I said pot is a gateway drug. It's just not a gateway drug to heroin for pot users. It's a gateway drug to government money for the military and for the military industrial complex. Jay, thanks for sharing that story with us. That's pretty startling. Thank you for the call. Mike in Anchorage, Alaska, listening on iHeartRadio. Hey, Mike, what's up?
I just want to make a comment about Ed Snowden. Everybody's on him for breaking the law. So what did he do? He took an oath to not divulge secrets.
Well, I'm not sure he took an oath. He was working for a private for-profit corporation. I don't think you can take an oath to a private for-profit corporation. Shano says to get a security clearance, you have to take an oath. Okay, I may stand corrected. We'll see. But he certainly he violated the terms of his contract of employment.
Yes, but which is the higher authority? If you are an American citizen, I would, being a former member of the military, where I took an oath to uphold the Constitution, if he saw the Constitution, which is the highest law in the land, being violated routinely, he has a duty as a citizen to blow the whistle on that.
I agree.
And everybody's painting him as an enemy because he fled to China and Russia, right, which are our enemies. Well, if you are seeking to be protected from the largest military power in the world, are you going to go to their friends? Is he going to go to an allied country where they're going to extradite him back to the U.S.?
Right. Yeah, don't go to the U.K.
The U.S.?
Well, and by the way, if China and Russia are our enemies, they're doing a pretty bad job of it. I mean, China is our pretty much number one trading partner. I guess, set aside lumber and things, and lumber and oil in Canada is, but China is basically everything is sold in this country that's manufactured someplace is made in China. And Russia, we've got all kinds of trade deals with, and we're doing all kinds of business with, and they're the major supplier of fossil fuel resources to Northern Europe. And so
I don't mean there are actual enemies.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, that's what media is painting him as.
I know.
Right.
Yeah.
Because of where he's at.
Yeah.
Well, we used to be the place that people came to for asylum.
That's right.
And I think it's a shame that we are now the one seeking to silence someone. And look what happened to Bradley Manning. The reason he's fleeing to these places is because he doesn't want his voice to be snuffed out.
Yeah. this is, and this is, I had Daniel Ellsberg on the program a week or so ago, and he, you know, and he just told the story of what happened to him. He released the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times. The story came out that he was the leaker. When he was identified as the leaker, he was targeted for prosecution. It was about 3 weeks later. They arrested him. They took him to a police station, or an FBI office, whichever it was. They booked him. They put him before a judge for a bail hearing. The judge determined that his bail was $10,000, but he could be released on his own recognizance because he didn't represent a flight risk. He signed a paper, his own recognizance, and he walked out of he walked out and went home. That was Daniel Ellsberg. That's how we used to treat whistleblowers. I mean, he was still facing years and years in prison for leaking classified information. But, I mean, he was released on his own recognizance. Bradley Manning gets tortured. I mean, tortured. And this is what Ed Snowden was looking at, was the possibility that he would get tortured. I mean, thank you for the call. I saw a video this morning of a couple of police officers who arrested a young African-American man for videotaping them or for taking pictures of them. He had a dog with him. They arrested him and they shot his dog to death. It's on videotape.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and David Cobb is with you. You know, I regularly on this program rant about how the original sin in our constitutionally limited representative democratic republic that has become a constitutional monarchy is the result of the excesses of the Supreme Court. The original sin is money. Money in politics, money as speech, corporations, organized capital, having the rights of persons under the Constitution, and the group doing something about it is MoveToAmend.org. David Cobb, the national spokesperson for Move to Amend, former Green Party candidate for President of the United States, on the line with us. Hey, David.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I am great. It has been too long since we've talked. So I understand you have surpassed 500 local and county resolutions and 15 states saying it's time to amend the Constitution to say corporations aren't people and money is not speech.
Well, Tom, it's true. We've helped to pass over 500 city and county resolutions. Most of them deal with both corporate constitutional rights, also known as corporate personhood, and money is speech. Those 15 state resolutions, some are just about overturning Citizens United. Some are just about getting money out of elections. Some are about getting money out of elections and making it clear that corporations don't have constitutional rights. We've also, more importantly, helped to put this issue on the ballot in 28 jurisdictions, and we've won every single one of them. The point is that there is a growing awareness that the United States Constitution is the supreme law of the land. In essence, Tom, it codifies the social contract. Well, our current social contract is fundamentally flawed. It does not actually allow for a truly functioning democratic republic. More and more people are willing to acknowledge that. Now the question becomes and is becoming, how far are we willing to go? At Move to Amend, we are clear and explicit, and we are the only grouping that says, without doubt, we must amend the Constitution to say that only living, breathing human beings have any inherent, unalienable constitutional rights, and money is not speech. Those are two related but distinct legal doctrines, both created illegitimately by the United States Supreme Court, that are allowing a small ruling elite not just to exercise power, but to rule over us. I really appreciate how you're actually willing to talk about this becoming a de facto monarchy, but it's a monarchy based on capital. It's not even lineage anymore. And that's what Move to Amend is doing, mobilizing a nonviolent revolutionary movement that says we the people are actually supposed to govern in this country, and damn it all, we're going to.
David, educate me about constitutional conventions. Back, you know, for a long time, people would say to me, oh, we need a constitutional convention, and I would say, no, I don't want to open up the whole Constitution, particularly in an era when half the politicians participating in the process have been bought off by the Koch brothers, and tinker with it. And then, somebody was an attorney and a constitutional expert called me up and said, no, you can either drive a constitutional amendment like Move to Amend is proposing down through the legislature, through Congress, or you can drive it up from the states, and that's called a constitutional convention. under the Constitution. What is it, Article 4, Article 5? And
Article 5.
Article 5, yeah.
Exactly right.
Inform me and all of our listeners and viewers.
Well, let's be clear. There are two ways that the Constitution provides for an amendment, both of which are in Article 5. The first is the way we're most familiar with. Two-thirds of Congress pass a proposed amendment, then it goes to the states for ratification, either through state legislatures or state initiatives.
Is that the way every single one has been done since the Bill of Rights?
So far, absolutely yes, the way that ultimately everyone. However, several of them were provoked by calls for a constitutional convention, which is where the history gets both more complex but also more interesting, Tom.
Mm.
And Article 5 also provides that if two-thirds of the states call for a constitutional convention, then a convention is called, and whatever comes out of that process must still go through back to the states for ratification through a three-quarters process. But, Tom, it is the Constitution itself is silent on whether a convention can be called and open up everything or whether it can be called for express limited purposes. Virtually every constitutional scholar I've talked about has said, well, look, it gives the states the power to call a convention. So if a state votes to say we are calling a constitutional convention for the express purpose of considering the move to amend We the People Amendment to say only human beings have constitutional rights and money is not speech, then most scholars agree if that's the reason that that state called that convention, that's the only thing that can be actually proposed coming out of such a convention.
Now, does a convention mean that there's actually a convention that, you know, like a political party convention, a bunch of people get together in a room and hammer out?
No, that's again, where the complexity comes in, because most scholars agree that if a convention has been called for a precise, limited purpose, then there is no need for such a convention because the convention has already been called. So that's where I suspect your friend who is the lawyer that she or he was talking about, if a limited in scope convention is called by any state, there is an argument to be made that you do not need to actually have human beings come together and have a typical like political party style convention because it has already triggered the what the Constitution requires for the convention.
So if two-thirds of the states pass, this would have to be something other than a non-binding resolution, which is the stuff that has happened up to this point. Pass an actual
Correct.
An actual amendment to the Constitution in the wrapper of a call for a constitutional convention. Then Congress must convene and consider it? Do I have that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, not Congress. It goes to the states for consideration.
It completely bypasses Congress.
It completely bypasses Congress. And, Tom, if you look at what we're doing at Move to Amend in Minnesota, we're exceptionally proud to be working with State Senator John Marty, who has been our champion to try to pass binding legislation that actually triggers the Constitutional Convention. In other words, not a non-binding resolution, this is what we think, but instead calling for the Minnesota State Legislature to be the first state to call for a constitutional convention for the express purpose of ratifying the Move to Amend We the People Amendment. It is our contention that when two-thirds of the states call that, then we have triggered the constitutional convention. That much is clear.
Now, who
the question about whether
who arbitrates? That's the wrong word. Who's in charge of this process? I mean, when two-thirds of the states have hit this threshold, there has to be, I mean, at least a keeper of the vote. I mean, there has to be some mechanism to make this happen. If you're going around Congress, does the executive branch handle this? Does the judicial branch handle it?
Tom, I love how precise you are with your thinking. The answer is the vote total is actually capped by Congress. And that's why it's important to recognize that although we are triggering it through the Constitution, that Congress itself is responsible for doing that vote count, and the question about whether a constitutional convention is actually convened with living, breathing human beings is a function of what each of those states has called for.
Now, this would require each one excuse me, David, we just have a minute left. This would require each state to pass identical language, though, wouldn't it? Otherwise, you'd have a problem like you do with the House and Senate and having to go to conference.
Exactly right, and that's the reason why we think it's so important to get this language right. And, Tom, the second thing, I know we're running out of time, but I really want to underscore how important it is that we recognize that merely by building a movement calling for it, we begin to shift the political culture, because the amendment guaranteeing 18-year-olds the right to vote, it got nowhere in Congress until states began to call for a constitutional convention for the purpose of considering that. And within 1 year, less than 1 year, Tom, from states beginning that process, Congress got its act together and made a proposal.
Yeah, it was less than a year that it took from the time that was introduced until it was ratified. And you know what triggered that, David, according to some historians, is Barry McGuire's song, Eve of Destruction. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. We need to get Jackson Brown to write and perform a song.
I love it.
Right? Take it viral. I mean, you know, because Barry McGuire made that thing. Senator Brown and I have had this conversation on the air. Anyhow, David Cobb, movetoamend.org. David, keep up. You're doing God's work. Keep it up.
Thank you so much, Tom. Thanks for the opportunity.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Be sure to check it out. Go over there. Sign up. Participate. MoveToAmend.org. So I had a Republican on the board asking what is free health care. I was looking forward to that conversation. If you want to call back, feel free. I love debating people. Keith in Elgin, Illinois. Hey, Keith, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's on your mind today?
Good afternoon. I'd like to see somebody calling out our congressman and by name when they vote. Mm. I know you can probably go online and find out, but a lot of people don't have computers, especially down in the South.
Yeah.
We keep on hearing about the poorly paid people. Well, they don't have them. Well, let's see it in the newspapers. Name them.
Here's the problem, Keith.
Senators.
Most local newspapers are not locally owned. The ownership is remote. The ownership is corporate. Not only do they not give a rat's patootie about what the politicians are doing, they're part of the problem. They're part of the organizations that are corrupting the politicians.
Understood, but let's try and get the people who do care, other people who do care, putting out adverts in the newspapers. They're not going to ignore newspapers' money coming in.
Yeah, yeah. But again, then the problem is that the people with the big bucks who are willing to spend it to advertise in newspapers for political purposes are people who know that if they spend $1 million to influence public opinion and public policy, they will influence public policy in a way that will make them $10 million. It'll reduce regulations on their business, or it'll reduce the taxes on their profits or on their capital gains or on their income. And the people who would be calling out members of Congress who are corrupt tend not to have the money. They tend to be the working class, the working people of this country. I don't mean to be shooting down your argument, because I think it's wonderful, and I absolutely agree with you. It needs to be done. I think that it's going to be done increasingly in the United States by small activist groups that are not just locally based, but interconnected via social media, via the internet, via email, whatever it may be. But you know, like we saw with this example of Wendy Davis in Texas, you know, just going viral, and people coming out and saying, yes, you know, this is great. She's standing up against a very toxic piece of legislation, and only one small corner of it is cutting abortions from 24 down to 20 weeks. There are much larger portions of it that are extremely, extraordinarily toxic. And
locally based would be good.
Say what?
Locally based would be
yes.
Good.
Yeah, locally based.
And this is where
Move to Amend. You can open create a local chapter of Move to Amend. Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org. You can create a local chapter of Progressive Democrats of America. I believe that the same thing is true with MoveOn.org. I believe it's. I know it's true with some of the other groups. Other groups are more national. They just want you to join their national group. But, you know, I have no problem with that. But I'm a big fan of being able to show up at somebody's house 10 blocks from me on a Saturday afternoon and say, okay, let's paint some signs. And so I'm with you on that. I think that's where we need to go. So,
I agree. I don't vote yet.
Is that because you're not a citizen, or because you're?
I'm not a citizen yet. I'm one of the. One of the many who have taxation without representation in this country.
Right. Are you working on becoming a citizen?
Yes. My papers are in.
Yeah.
I delayed when you had Bush elected.
Yes. caused a lot of people to take a deep swallow.
See, I thought, what?
Yeah.
Now, you know, I don't know whether to withdraw my papers now with what has been demonstrated, private companies looking at me.
Yeah.
You know.
I suspect it's happening all over the world, Keith, which is not to not to condone it. But, it's to say we need a worldwide movement to say enough to both corporate power and to the increasing autocracy, plutocracy, and frankly, autocratic, authoritarian forms of government that are slowly and creepingly replacing what used to be democracies, whether it's in Western and Northern Europe or whether it's here in the United States.
That wonderful poem.
Which was?
When they came for the communists.
Oh, Pastor Nemo.
Didn't object. Yes. What a man.
Yes. Yeah, he said it right.
What a man.
Keith, thank you very much for the call, and thanks for your thoughts. Very, very thought-provoking. Mo in New York City, listening on WWRL. Hey, Mo, what's up?
Oh, hello. I was wondering what you thought of the fact that Manning is in the military. Doesn't that make a substantial difference?
It does.
To his treatment in Ellsberg's.
It does.
I did have something else.
But he was not the only one. There have been five NSA whistleblowers outside of Manning, and several of them have been treated, shall we say, rather shabbily. And I think Ed Snowden was looking at, and this administration has prosecuted more people under the Alien and Sedition Act, or under the Espionage Act, rather, than all previous presidents put together.
I had another question for you, though. If spouses, same-sex spouses, are admitted to this country, will that result in a substantial increase in the number of heterosexual same-sex marriages?
Heterosexual same-sex marriages. Isn't that an oxymoron?
Doing it to get somebody into the country.
Oh.
What if
you mean fraudulent marriages.
Somebody gets the money that the family, you know, doesn't
yeah.
the will.
You're talking about fraudulent marriages.
No, not fraudulent. There's no love, but it's a genuine marriage.
Yeah. I can tell you from having been through the process with the Immigration and Naturalization Service for my brother-in-law, who married a woman who is not a U.S. citizen and now is, that they are, A, quite rigorous about making sure that this is actually a marriage relationship, not a convenience marriage relationship, and B, that the penalties for trying to bamboozle them, for trying to convince them that you're actually in love with somebody and you're really getting married for the reasons that people typically get married, as opposed to somebody just handing you $40,000 and saying, help me become a citizen, the penalties for that are severe. People can
I want my friend who's poor and a good artist, I want him to inherit my money and make sure the family doesn't dispute it. So I can marry him, and then he gets the money.
You can do that by contract, Mo.
What?
You can do that by contract.
I don't think so. The family, if you're a spouse, it's very hard. You're entitled to one-third of the...
You could create a corporation, put all the money into the corporation, and then make him the largest stockholder. I mean, actually, I don't know. That may not work at all. You shouldn't be taking estate planning advice from me, because I don't have a clue and I've got no estate. So, Mo, I doubt that that's... I mean, that may happen, but I doubt that that's a big concern of anybody. Thank you for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Anything goes summer here on the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be back with more of your calls, my thoughts, and the news of the day right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Little Rush Limbaugh for you. Here we go. Turn him on.
Hold the people at Fox. I wanted to talk about this today. That was three or four times, and they wouldn't do it.
Really?
They were not interested in bringing this subject up. I wanted to talk about this.
This is Rush Limbaugh saying he went on Fox today, and he was censored. Isn't that interesting? Interestingly, I've been broadcasting for 10 years now, and I was on Air America. I've been on Fox. I've been on, you know, I did a show for Clear Channel for a couple of years. I've never been censored. I'm on RT, on RT TV. I've never been censored anywhere by anybody. When I was on Air America, I used to get, you know, there was a fair amount of time. People would offer opinions. Hey, you ought to have this guy on. You ought to do it. But, you know, I was free to ignore them and usually did. poor Shane, he just lost it. Anyhow, back to your calls. Vi in Donovan, Missouri. Hey, Vi, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Good afternoon, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better, Vi. How about you?
Yeah, I hope we all do. I was only calling to agree with the earlier caller from Texas who was talking about progressives versus regressives. And I'm living that, and there is a big difference.
In Missouri, you mean?
In Missouri.
Yeah. So how do you identify that difference, and do you think it's a regionally based difference?
Tom, I'm not sure, but let me give you an example. We had a special election to elect a U.S. congressperson a few weeks ago. There was a moderate Democrat candidate running, not nearly progressive enough for me. And then there was the other, the Republican candidate, who was a Tea Party affiliate, Rick Santorum endorsed. And I went, I took my, well, I voted, and then I took my mother to the voting polls. And these guys that jumped out of old rickety pickups, you know, and I hate to stereotype, but, you know, the ones with the guns in the back back windows, they could not get to the polling place quick enough to vote for this nut.
For the Republican Tea Party guy.
For the Republican. And we went from having a corporatist in a, for a congressperson to a wingnut. So we have actually, like you say, I'm calling it regressive.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think
this is such a rural area, and it's such a poor area, and people are voting against their interests at every election.
Yep. Well, that's because they're being taught, they're being, you know, what's being thrown to them is gender and race. They're being told, you know, that these poor white men, basically working class poor white men, are being told that women want their jobs, women want control of their lives, you know, of the men's lives as well as their own lives, and that people of color want their jobs and eventually want control of things. And so they're freaked out.
I am reading your book, Cracking the Code,
because
I'm trying to learn how to talk to people, you know, instead of just being a rabble-rouser. I'm really trying to learn the art of communication, and I think your book is going to be very helpful.
Good. I hope so.
And
that's why I wrote it.
You are a lifeline to me. I watch your show every day, and if it wasn't for you, I would never even have a chance to discuss or hear progressive ideas, and I thank you for your work, sir.
Well, thank you, Vi.
Keep it up for us.
I will do my very best. I'm having a good time doing it, so I'm going to keep on doing it. Vi, thank you for your kind words, and I wish you the very best in the 4th of July holiday that's coming up. Dorothy in Wheat Ridge, Colorado. Hey, Dorothy, thanks for listening to 760 AM. What's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
I get so angry at this government anymore. I could spit nails.
About what?
But as this kid, this Snowden, he's given his future to this country. They're going to hound him to death now, no matter what.
Yeah.
And all the other people that did us a favor by letting us know what was going on that most probably was illegal. And Cheney's still walking the streets. Those banksters are still loose. But they go after these people like they committed treason.
Yep.
And those guys are the ones that committed treason. And nobody seems to mind about that.
Yeah, they actually brought the country to its knees, and Cheney actually blew a CIA operation that involved lots and lots of people. Probably people died, and certainly Valerie Plame lost her anonymity, her cover. Her cover was blown. You know what's interesting, Dorothy?
Okay, don't we have a Justice Department that's on the level?
Not really. No, our Attorney General is an old corporate lawyer, so you know he's. Seems like he's a decent guy, but he's an old corporate lawyer, so he cuts corporations slack and he goes after individuals.
Well, I'm at the point where if Obama, all he has to do now is throw the seniors in the dirt, I'm about to give my citizenship to anybody that wants it. I am so sick of this lot.
Well, don't give up yet, Dorothy. This country has been through a lot worse. We've been in much worse places. I mean, just think how you felt 4, 5, 6 years ago when George Bush was president. I think it's going to get worse before it gets better, but I think it is going to get better because the American people, in their heart, in their core, are progressive. So, Dorothy, thank you for the call. Thank you for raising the topic. I just want to tell you a very quick story. The Talk Radio News Service shares the floor of this building with us. We're in downtown Washington, D.C., about 4 blocks from the Capitol and 3 blocks from the Supreme Court. And one of the people who works for Ellen over at the Talk Radio News Service is a staunch Republican. I mean, I've known this guy for years, and he's very nice, and he's very smart, and he's very conservative. And in the elevator, Louise and I were coming up with him in the elevator, and he's like, a Republican, conservative Republican news guy who does a really good job of just writing the news and not being conservative Republican about it. But still, you know, he says words to the effect of, I don't get this Snowden thing. He says, why didn't they just say, okay, Mr. Snowden, you've given your testimony. We would like you to testify before Congress. We will try you in a court of law. You'll be facing a couple of years in jail. And when you finish that jail sentence, you'll still be in your 30s, and you'll probably be able to get a very good job as a computer operator someplace. And, I mean, Daniel Ellsberg was released on his own recognizance when he was arrested for leaking the Pentagon Papers. Why do they have to go after a fly with a sledgehammer or a 12-gauge shotgun? It's like they overreact to everything. And frankly, I think it's because they've got this whole corporate thing running them. The corporate part of the military-industrial security complex, military-industrial security private prison complex, has, you know, it's got 70% of the budget now. It's no longer our government spying on us. It's these big corporations that are owned by, you know, Booz Allen Hamilton stockholders, which include Carlyle Group, and among its stockholders are the Bin Laden family. They're the ones who are driving the train. And it's bizarre. Pete in Elkins, Arkansas, I have a feeling you want to riff on something very similar. It says here, corporate fascism, Pete. You are on the air, Pete.
Oh, great. No, it's just that this fascist corporate takeover, the seeds were planted 50 years ago, back when Eisenhower insulted John Birch Society. And
how did Eisenhower insult the John Birch Society? I thought the major insult to the JBS was Earl Warren and Brown v. Board of Education in 54.
Well, Eisenhower said that it's a small group of people, but they're very stupid.
Oh, yeah, but that was in a private letter to his brother. That wasn't released until after he was out of office. In fact, I'm not even sure it was released until he was dead.
I was thinking that would be the initial stone thrown.
No. This was his brother Edgar was a Bircher. He was a hardcore right wing conservative, and he wrote Dwight a long letter about how Dwight was a lousy president because he was compromising with people and he was extending. So he expanded Social Security, strengthened union rights, and he ran on that platform. In fact, in 1956 for reelection. And his brother Edgar just took him to the woodshed for it, and he wrote a letter back to Edgar saying, you know, I actually am a conservative, and I am a good president, and there are times when you have to do what the people want. And anybody who comes along and tries to do away with Social Security or farm programs, protections for farmers, or et cetera, I don't remember the exact language of it, is mistaken. There is a small group of people down in Texas, including the Hunt brothers, who think that they can do this. I would say the modern-day version is the Koch brothers. He said their number is small and they are stupid. But that was a private letter that he sent to his brother Edgar.
Oh, okay. Well, no, I was just assuming that that was...
No, it didn't. That didn't become public until after the 60s at the earliest.
So, right.
Yeah. But I think that the stone with regard to the Birch Society, if you want to say that a stone was thrown, there was an insult to the Birchers by the Eisenhower administration, it was Dwight Eisenhower continuing the New Deal. I mean, they had been looking for somebody to roll back the New Deal in its entirety as much as possible, get rid of the minimum wage, get rid of unemployment insurance, get rid of privatized Social Security, stop all the WPA, CCC, all the alphabet agencies. And Ike basically said, no, I'm not going to do that. End the GI Bill. He said, I'm not going to do that stuff, you know, because these are things that are popular with the American people. These are the things that got me into office and got me reelected. And that was an insult to Daddy Koch and the John Birch Society that he funded so heavily. And now, of course, his sons are carrying on in his tradition. We'll be back right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I believe we're going to be checking in with the Talk Radio News Service in a few minutes. And in the meantime, we'll be taking your calls, my thoughts, the news of the day. To you by the magic of Hungary at the Smithsonian Folklife Festival. Learn about the Hungary program with the Hungarian Heritage Roots to Revival app at folklife.hu. And Ellen, we were just talking about malaria drugs.
Something like that. Yeah, I take a different malaria pill because of the psychosis.
Yeah,
risk.
I just took good old fashioned tetracycline.
You can do that. It's effective in some kinds of malaria. Not. I take Malarone, and today was my last day.
Uh-huh,
because you take it for 7 days afterwards.
Right.
And I got about 10 mosquito bites, and Colonel Logan, who runs U.S. Army labs for the whole a continent, told me there's about 1 in 4 or 5 mosquitoes now in our area that I was in that have it. So,
wow.
I'm careful.
Keep taking those meds. So what's going on in the
okay,
news?
Okay, well, quite a bit. Of course, we have the Snowden story continuing with some countries turning him down. There's some countries that have not answered. Now, it's interesting, certain of the right-wing things say, well, he's been turned down everywhere. No, he hasn't been turned down everywhere. There are places like Iceland, Venezuela, Cuba, and even China who have not necessarily turned him down.
Oh, that's interesting. Why did he withdraw his submission to Russia?
Well, it's unclear.
Putin had put terms on it?
Because of Putin's terms, I think. Now, as you know, WikiLeaks is doing sort of some of his money collecting, and my brother Michael Ratner, who I know was on your show last week, is Julian Assange's attorney.
Right.
So,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, but Michael said he hadn't talked to
No, to
Ed Snowden and didn't know what his
right.
details of his situation.
And then Ed Snowden's father talked, but the father hasn't talked to Snowden. So.
Right. Yeah, well, his dad, I mean, he's just being protected. He's trying to do something
right.
with his son.
Right.
God bless him.
Okay. So the president called President Morsi yesterday. Who's
of Egypt.
Of Egypt. And apparently Reuters is reporting that the Egyptian army has a written plan. And this plan calls for an interim civilian council to rule until there can be new elections and that they're arranged. The parliament would be suspended. And the Obama apparently suggested to the Morsi government that there be early elections, that they call for new elections.
Yeah. Well, parliament's already suspended, is it not? Didn't
well, this would continue whatever.
Yeah.
In other words, it would not. Even if you're elected, you would not be serving at
right.
this point until there are new elections. Rand Paul never found a time that he didn't want to make a comment on something so that he could make some news, particularly during a congressional recess.
Yeah, this is the new joke. You know, it used to be the most dangerous place in Washington, D.C. was between John McCain and a camera. Now it's Rand
yes.
Paul and a camera. Anyway,
absolutely. He said that Egyptians think that Morsi is a U.S. puppet, and therefore we should not be giving any heavy or sending any heavy equipment to Egypt at this point, any weapons, things like that, because we're so disregarded. And in that light, actually, the U.S. Ambassador Ann Patterson, she's been criticized with all kinds of unflattering caricatures. And, of course, women have been told to stay away from Tahrir Square because there was been these gang rapes and that kind
right.
of thing.
Which appear to be the Muslim groups who
yes.
want to put women back in burqas. And they're using the, she was out in public, so let's
right.
You know, this is
yes.
This is our, you know, I agree with Rand Paul on that. If I
well, actually, I do too.
Yeah.
Why are we sending? Oh, it's not to our advantage.
Yeah. Don't send weapons into a conflict zone.
Right.
You know, just stay
unless
stay
it's
back.
Our conflict and we got enough problems.
Yeah. There you go.
Okay, Bernie Sanders today issued a report based on a GAO report, which said that companies, U.S. companies operating overseas, these are not, it's not like Tom Hartman, Ellen Ratner, who don't operate our little businesses overseas. We operate them in the United States. But these are multinationals.
Right.
And they pay just 12.6% of their reported worldwide profits.
In taxes,
which is less than the 35%, which is the going tax rate. And he said basically there's $100 billion in taxes that we're not collecting. This is what Senator Sanders said today.
Yeah, he's right. I mean, our corporate tax collections are lower than they've been in 60 years, and corporate profits are higher than they've been in 60 years. When Eisenhower was president, about a third of the total income to the federal government came from corporate taxes. Now it's about 11%.
Big change, to say the least. There's a new book on Governor Romney. I don't know if you've been hearing about it, if you've been talking about
no,
it.
No, I haven't been talking about it, so please tell the story.
Dan Baltz wrote about it. He said that there was a family meeting as to whether he should run for president, and Romney voted no for himself, but I guess the family outvoted him. And then once he did decide to run, and Newt won the South Carolina primary. I think you came down to South Carolina with me. I was going to. All right.
Ended up having surgery.
Then what happened is his team had these kill Newt meetings.
Literally?
Literally. Well, I'm not literally.
I mean,
but
yeah,
yes.
But that was the
phrase.
That's
what they called the meetings, the kill Newt meetings.
There was a funny headline over at Daily Kos. Mitt Romney voted against himself running for president because he's so patriotic.
Ha! Huh. That is very funny. Okay. Secretary of Education Duncan today spoke at the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools. There are 6,000 public charter schools in the United States, 2.3 million students. And he basically said, one, they're not meeting the need that is there in terms of public students. They also are more likely to suspend or expel students than regular public schools, and they need to make more public buildings available so that they can start these charter schools for public schools.
So wait a minute. The charter schools aren't working, so we need to give them more resources?
Well, he's saying they don't have the right resources. I mean, he was speaking to a group of charter schools.
Right, I know.
They're public charter schools,
right. This is my
right.
problem with Arne Duncan. He's a big fan of private charter,
right?
For-profit corporate schools.
Also, as you know, President Obama and President Bush 43 arranged their trip so that they coincided in Tanzania. They laid a wreath in front of the embassy this morning. But interesting, also on that, they interviewed the first ladies. Michelle Obama said, "Well, it's a very nice jail, but the White House is basically a prison."
Wow. I suspect there's a lot of truth to that. It's a really nice person. This Talk Radio News Service brought to you by the magic of Hungary, folklife.hu. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Nathan White is with us. He's the national spokesman for Restore the Fourth. The website is Restore the Fourth, and it's spelled out, FOURTH.net. And Nathan, welcome to the program.
Tom, thanks for having me on.
The Fourth, of course, being the Fourth Amendment.
It's the Fourth Amendment, and we're going out on the 4th of July. We're a national organization. We're nonpartisan, very peaceful, very grassroots, organic, raising up, I think somebody counted today, we're 23 days old, and we're organizing national rallies in 81 cities across the country. You can find your local rally at Restore the Fourth, spelled out restorethefourth.net. We've got 81 rallies that have all been crowdsourced. So the way that works is we used an internet platform called Reddit to start talking to each other. Mm-hmm. People found out what was going on, and they were outraged, and that outrage transitioned into.
They found out what was going on with the NSA spying and all this kind of stuff.
With the NSA spying, yeah, in the Snowden leaks in particular. Yeah. They found out what's going on and they wanted to get involved. They wanted to do something. They wanted action. And we realized there are a lot of us here. We have a voice. What can we do? We can go out and make that voice heard.
Right.
So we crowdsourced the entire endeavor. We said, well, we're going to need a website. And somebody says, I can build a website. I've got some skills there. And we build a website. said, we're going to need some marketing materials. We're going to need flyers and people who had design skills, put forth ideas, and we put them onto the website. We needed a press release, so we put that out, and people wrote press releases, and we put those on the website. We coalesced around people who were willing to spend a little more time and develop some structure, but we crowdsourced every aspect of it. Once we had that information on the website, then people could then find it, go and organize their own event in their own town, and now we have 81 rallies across the country. For the 4th of July.
At RestoreTheFourth, F-O-U-R-T-H.net.
Exactly. Restore the 4th this 4th. And all of the rallies have their own speakers. They've arranged their own events, their own tents, their own permits. But we have been getting some national endorsements, and I can do almost the entire show on national endorsements.
Okay.
We've been working with great organizations. We have been working with StopWatching.us, that's StopWatching.us, which is a group of 86 internet companies and startups and nonprofits that have come together to oppose NSA spying and give you resources where you can go in and you can put down your information, and it'll help you contact your member of Congress.
Hmm. Are any of those large companies whose people would recognize their names?
Mozilla is probably the biggest one that people would recognize. Uh-huh. Mozilla is
Firefox.
Also, exactly. Mozilla, which creates Firefox, is also part of the Internet Defense League, which just today announced that they will be supporting us by putting their cat logo on all of their members' websites, which is 30,000 websites. That includes Electronic Frontier Foundation, Mozilla, Reddit, WordPress, MoveOn, some of the biggest websites in the country. On the 4th, are going to be putting up a logo and helping people find their local rallies so they can join until we can spread the message online while we're also offline.
But that's their logo, not your logo.
They have a special logo that they actually designed after the SOPA PIPA fight, kind of like a bat signal for the internet, and people like cats on the internet, so it's a cat signal.
Yeah.
And it's basically the bat signal for there's something bad going on, and we all need to pay attention to this right now.
So people click on that, and it takes them to your website?
It'll take them. They created a website that's going to be just for this, it's going to have some of our information in it so you can find your rally. And it's also going to have some of the Stop Watching Us information so you can contact Congress. Right. Some other groups.
One of the things that's so cool about this is just that you guys are not trying to build an empire. I mean, this is the kind of the old-fashioned way this kind of would get done is the, I'm going to make this my group, and this is going to be around my ego, and it's going to, you know, and you're absolutely creating something that's horizontal rather than vertical.
Well, we want to harness the power of people because that's really what this is. When people found out, they were outraged. It wasn't one person saying, I'm going to go and I'm going to create outrage and then use them as my army to make a point. This is people coming together and saying, this is not okay.
Yeah, we are the people we've been waiting for.
But part of this comes from the history of how this happened, that a lot of this got started with the Patriot Act. The Patriot Act was passed, I think it was about a month after September 11th. Yeah. It was not passed in response to September 11th security failings. It would not have fixed the problem. It was a long list of things that law enforcement had wanted for many, many years. And in some cases, Congress had said, no, that's too much. That would impose on people civil liberties. But after 9/11, there was this fear, and we just had to do everything. We had to take the gloves off. We had to go after the enemy. And we passed these really broad measures, and they've been reauthorized three times. And each time they're reauthorized, Congress waits until the very last minute and doesn't allow for really any debate.
Right.
So we as a nation have not yet had the conversation about what is acceptable and what we are willing to let the government do on our behalf.
And when the original Patriot Act was passed, as that conversation started, the two guys who could have stopped it in Congress, Tom Daschle and Pat Leahy, both got anthrax in the mail, and that ended that conversation.
Yeah. It was a scary time.
Yeah.
We don't doubt that, but we as a nation need to reflect. There's always been a balance between security and freedom. Usually it's in the Judiciary Committee where Congress balances what law enforcement wants and what's best for society. You think when telegrams were first invented, there wasn't law enforcement that wanted to read them?
Sure.
We now have new tools, and it's possible to tap into the internet. And we use the internet for almost everything. And because these new tools exist, government is going to want to use them, and it's our responsibility to have that conversation about where the balance is. It's interesting that on the private sector side, there is a conversation that's happening about this. There's several big data marketing firms that put third-party cookies on your websites, and so they can track where you go, not just when you're on Facebook, but where you go from Facebook and where you go from Google, what you're searching and where that leads you to, and they build these profiles about what they want to sell to you.
Right.
That is concerning to some people. Marketers think it's a great idea. To other people, they think it's a huge invasion of their privacy. But there's a conversation that's happening right now. People online are supporting, some people are supporting something called Do Not Track, which would allow, would make it so these third-party cookies couldn't get onto your computer and track where you're going. FTC Commissioner Brill just last week came up with an idea called Reclaim Your Name, where she suggested that the big data marketing companies should come together and create a website so where you could go and see what kind of information was being collected about you, and say when you don't want information to be collected, see if there was information that was wrong, but at least you would know.
This is an Obama appointee.
She's fairly pretty new. She deserves a lot of credit for that. But on the private side, these big data tools exist, and people are using them in some ways that people don't like, but there's a conversation about where the balance is.
Right.
When society develops and there's new tools and new technologies, there's a conversation about a balance of how are we going to use these tools, but how are we going to protect who we are as a nation? And we haven't really done that on the national security level for these big data tools.
Yeah.
And I'm speaking for myself here. I'm very grateful that the nation is having that conversation right now.
Yep.
That people are saying, I'm going to put down the hot dogs and the hamburgers for just a couple hours, and I'm going to go out, and I'm going to be part of this conversation because it's so important. Mm. If we don't have this conversation now, even if you absolutely trust this government, 15 years from now it'll be too late. We won't get the option to have this conversation once it's enshrined in the law.
Right. And it has been for almost a decade, and it's, in fact, for more than a decade.
Yeah, more than a decade. Yeah. But it's interesting. When the Office of Legal Counsel puts out a memo, it's called a legal opinion. Mm. And I think that word is actually important, opinion. It is our opinion that this is the law, and we are going to act on the belief that it is true. Mm. But it only becomes really ratified once it's challenged in the courts and upheld. There have been several big examples recently where, DOMA, for instance, where for more than a decade, the government operated under the belief that a law passed by Congress was legal.
So are you arguing for judicial review of the Patriot Act, or are you arguing for an amendment or repeal of the Patriot Act? Or none of the above, just for a conversation?
Well, we as a group are suggesting amend and repeal the Patriot Act. However, we're not getting into too detailed of legislative fixes. That's a phrase we throw around in D.C. all the time.
That's what we hire legislators for.
Exactly. We hire people. We pay them money to go to Washington and work on our behalf.
Right.
I don't think you can expect somebody who's trying to work in minimum wage, trying to hold down a job, trying to raise a family, trying to keep their kids off the streets, to be able to read every bill in Congress and know what it's going to do. So we're demanding that the members of Congress do it for them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Nathan White, Restore the Fourth. He's national spokesman of Restore, R-E-S-T-O-R-E, the Fourth, F-O-U-R-T-H.net. Thank you, Nathan.
Thanks for having me on.
20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Talk Media for the Sane Among Us. Tom Hartman with you. And Mike in Fairfax, Virginia. My call screener is convinced you are a paid Republican shill. Prove us otherwise.
Yeah. You know, you guys always say that. Can you guys send me an email with some of the links so I can get paid? Because I always hear that as a cop-out excuse. I've looked on the internet, and I've never been able to find where
so
I
you admit it.
Check.
Oh, no, you deny it, but that's a, you know,
no, I'm not
in any case.
Paid, but I'd like
okay,
to
so what's your riff today?
Where to go? Huh?
What's your riff today?
You're not going to tell me where to go.
To look for that? Oh, you can, yeah. You, I, no, I'm not. I don't know where to go.
Okay, me neither, so.
I know that you can Google it. I've read the articles. I've seen the things. We've had paid, people who are paid to post on our message board come right out and tell us that they were doing it for money, and in one case tell us where. Now, that was back in 2004. That guy was being paid for by the RNC. But I don't know.
I wanted to talk about.
You know, so you might want to start with the RNC. They may well still be paying people to post things and to call radio shows.
So with regard to the immigration.
So in your rehearsal, you want to say.
Huh?
In your rehearsal for a paid job, you wanted to say.
Yeah, so I've been watching the immigration coverage and listening on Sirius Left, and it kind of cracks me up.
Mm-hmm.
So the Senate is enlightened in this passage of this bill that's over 1,000 pages laden with pork, and somehow John Boehner is portrayed as this idiot who's just an obstructionist and playing hard politics for his own gain. But the last time I looked...
Yeah, I don't think that any of that characterizes the way that I've characterized this legislation. It's a pretty simplistic... I can't speak for anybody else on Sirius Left or any other progressive host, but none of those are ways that I would characterize this piece of legislation.
When did it become the political norm that the other body of the legislature was obligated to take on the bills of the other branch?
Well, it never was. It's in the Constitution that all legislation that involves spending or taxation has to originate in the House, although they don't always follow that. They'll pass a bill out of the Senate and then use it as a wrapper in the House and then pass it back to the Senate. But if the two bodies don't agree, they send it to a conference committee where they work out their differences or don't.
Correct.
and create one bill that then gets re-voted on by both bodies. So I don't understand what your complaint is.
But the last time I looked, the House had passed over 100 bills that wouldn't even get to the floor in the Senate for debate.
And vice versa.
Sirius Left. Huh?
And vice versa. The Senate's passing legislation. It's been, in fact, today it was 100 days since the Senate passed a budget that has under a $1 trillion deficit, which are all the Republicans say they want, and that would have kept the government operating and that would have, funded things actually in ways that were quite conservative. Way too conservative for my liking, but the Senate passed it with both Republicans and Democrats voting for it. And for 100 days, John Boehner has refused to take a vote on a budget, or on this budget, on the Senate's budget.
And while that is shocking, I think it's more shocking that we're going into the second term of the Obama administration and we still don't have a budget.
Yeah, it's not at all shocking. We still don't have a budget because John Boehner won't bring it up in the House of Representatives. It actually passed the Senate.
That's not true. That's your budget. There were 12 budgets prior to that one that passed out of the House with even Democratic votes that went to the Senate and didn't even get to the floor for debate.
Those were insane budgets.
Even Obama's own budget got voted down in the House and Democrats voted against it.
Yeah, that was a strategic misfire on the part of the administration. The bottom line, though, is that, and you know this as well as I do, Mike, that the night that President Obama was inaugurated, a group of Republicans got together here in town at the Caucus Room restaurant and swore basically a blood oath to each other that they would do everything they could to destroy his presidency, which meant block his legislative agenda. I think it was Jeb Hensarling said that they were going to do it based on the model of the Taliban.
That's an intriguing story. All I will say is that it is not the norm in politics that the other house has to take on a bill that came out of the other.
Well, that's how legislation always gets passed. So you can call it not the norm, but they've been doing it since the George Washington administration.
And both sides block bills. And so to call one side an obstructionist and the other side a political genius is the worst kind of spin I've heard.
Who have I called a political genius?
Huh?
Who have I called a political genius?
I will say you're pretty fair about criticizing Harry Reid, but on the other side, whenever the House passes a bill, whether it's, let's say it's a repeal of Obamacare or modification of Obamacare, the House will pass it with a sizable majority, and then Harry Reid will say, "I ain't getting to the floor for a debate." And
well, that's because the majority of the Republicans in the House of Representatives are nuts.
They're
37 times they've passed bills to do away with Obamacare. What's Harry Reid supposed to do with that? That's not what the American people want. It's not what the Senate wants.
Right,
it's stupid. It's just an empty gesture for the Tea Party crazies back home.
If that's the case, then lobby Harry Reid to bring it to the floor for open debate, and he won't do it because he knows he'll lose the Democrats. The only reason Obamacare passed in the first place is because Obama bought a vote with his executive order banning abortion and then flip-flopped.
If you're going to complain about Harry Reid, I'm curious your take on the Hastert rule. Do you think it's appropriate that John Boehner say, even though a majority of members of the House of Representatives want to vote on a piece of legislation, that he will not bring it to the floor for a vote because a majority of the Republican caucus doesn't support it?
It's a political maneuver, and it's appropriate because it's within the rules.
Okay, so when John Boehner does it, it's fine. When Harry Reid does it, it's wrong.
No, it's fine when they both do it, is my point.
Okay.
It's fine if it's within the rules of the legislative body to do that political maneuver.
Okay, so then I don't get what you're complaining about.
Ways. Huh?
I don't get what you're complaining about.
I'm complaining about the criticism of John Boehner for doing the political maneuvers when Harry Reid does it every day in the Senate by denying.
You think John Boehner doesn't do it every day in the House?
What's that?
You think John Boehner doesn't do it every day in the House?
Perfectly acceptable.
He's been doing it for 100 days now with the Senate budget. Every single day.
It's fine on both bodies to use the rules.
So what are you complaining about?
I'm complaining about the coverage and the portrayal of one as being an obstructionist, and the other one, that's just the way we do things here. It's pathetic. And so I'll tell you the reason Harry Reid won't...
Mike, you know as well as I do that those bills that were passed out of the House of Representatives with no Democratic support, no, and Democrats are not voting to end Obamacare, those were not passed in the hopes that they would become legislation. Those were passed as a way of saying to the Tea Partiers back home, hey, in the primary, please don't primary. You know that. Listen, Mike is out of steam. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. We'll talk. We'll talk again, I'm sure. And someday you'll get paid. Just hang in there.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And Mike, when you go to the RNC and ask them to pay you to call into radio shows, ask them why they flipped the stars upside down and they got the satanic stars on their logo. I am dying to find out. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. With a mouthful of peanut butter. Boy, don't eat a spoonful of peanut butter before you go on the air. I walked into the other room and Louise is in there and she's like, boy, I just had some peanut butter. And I was like, oh, I got to have that. Oh, by the way, yesterday in the chat room, a couple of people were asking about Higgins, our cat, who Louise took to the vet on, what was it, Friday last week, I think, or Monday this week? Yeah, it was last Friday. And he had been barfing and losing weight. And the vet said, and we hadn't, I didn't have the blood work back by the time we got off the air on Friday. And my apologies for not bringing you up to date today. Higgins, last night at 10 o'clock, I hear this meow, 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 meow. Open the door to the bathroom, and there's Higgins standing in the shower going, meow, 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 meow. Turn on the shower, please, on my face.
Meow, 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 meow.
Yeah, there you go. This is how Higgins drinks. Anyway, or how Higgins likes to drink. He gets totally soaked, and then he wants to jump on the bed. But all of that said, the Higgins problem appears to be that he has hyperthyroidism. Apparently, this is really, really common in old cats. And there's three ways you can treat it. You can burn part of the thyroid away with radiation. You can give them a drug that counters iodine in the body. Or you can put them on a diet of cat food that doesn't have iodine in it, doesn't have kelp in it. Apparently, most cat foods have kelp in them, which is seaweed. And I'm looking at this going, okay, I understand why humans need iodine, because we are the aquatic apes. I mean, you know, we're the hairless apes. We're the ones humans evolved near sea coasts. And perhaps even there was a bottleneck event where the human race actually had to stand in the water for a generation or two. It's probably why humans are the only ape that can give birth underwater. And we can. Baby can survive underwater 4, 5, 6, 8 minutes, as long as the placenta is attached and intact. And so it makes sense that we would need iodine, because iodine's abundant in the ocean. You know, you get iodine from seafood. But and that's why, you know, humans who live in those parts of the country that are iodine deficient, like parts of the Midwest, get goiters. And that's why they started iodizing salt back in the 40s, I think it was, to do it, which did away with goiters in the United States, which is when the thyroid swells up because it doesn't have enough iodine. But why would cats need iodine? Cats don't, you know, they didn't evolve near seacoasts. And so when I discovered that the cure for hyperthyroidism in cats is to put them on cat food that doesn't have seaweed added to it, and it takes about 6 weeks for that to kind of the iodine to slowly wash out of their system, and then they get normal, I thought, are we creating an epidemic of hyperthyroidism among cats by feeding them kelp in all our cat foods? I mean, could it be because they're applying human nutrition standards to cats, which is like crazy because cats are carnivores and we're omnivores or vegetarians or frugivores, or, you know, there's a debate about that, but we don't have the fangs that cats have. We don't have the claws that cats have. Our bodies are not designed to kill things and eat them raw. I mean, you could argue that we're not designed to eat them cooked either, but I mean, we're clearly more in the category of plant eaters than flesh eaters, evolutionarily speaking. And some of our close relatives, I mean, gorillas are vegetarians. So chimpanzees are not altogether, but they do eat meat. But And they're closer to us, I guess, than any of the others of the apes. But nonetheless, I'm just wondering out loud. So we actually have three cats, and Higgins is one of the three. He's my cat. And so we're just putting all three of the cats on the iodine free diet. The vet says that's fine, no big deal. And you know, once a month or so, you can toss a iodine containing treat to the other two cats, and they'll get their iodine. I'm not sure that they need it. Although I may be going up against all veterinary theory. So, but that's everything. That's the Higgins story. Hang on just a second. Louise says that she just ordered some herbs. What was that? Lemon balm and bugle weed, which are supposed to calm down Higgins' thyroid. Okay, so Louise is doing herbal medicine on Higgins too. So once the delivery arrives in the mail. Marco in Tinley Park, Illinois, listening on WCPT. Hey, Marco, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm
an Argentine-American. I came to the States in 2002. I'm 27 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I just saw, and I became involved in politics when I became a citizen here. And I'm seeing this country go or take a lot of the same decisions that, you know, Argentina took, especially during the 80s and the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm all for civil liberty, and I'm a social liberal. I think, you know, gay couples should be all marriage and all that stuff. But, you know, I mean, I saw the unions destroyed in Argentina. I saw the middle class completely destroyed in Argentina. And, you know, they took a socialist approach to the way they run the country. And I just wanted to, if you could have a little input on that and what you thought of it. I don't know if you're too familiar with it or not.
Yeah, I'm no scholar of Argentinian history, and you probably know a whole lot more than I do since you were Argentinian, but... my understanding is that basically you had a rightist government there that was dancing to the tune of the corporations, that AT&T, the old company here in the U.S. that was in the phone business or the communications business that was in tight with the CIA, was playing a big role in corrupting your government. I'm back to the Eisenhower administration. And that eventually, you know, it was the leftists who said enough of this stuff, you know, screw the IMF. I was in Argentina in 81, no, in 2001. Yeah, in 2001, when it was the year after the Great Crash. Correct me if I'm wrong on my history.
You're right, yeah.
Yeah. And you know, the currency had collapsed and the IMF was, you know, had tried to hold you guys hostage. And I was staying in a middle-class neighborhood, and a lot of the people had, you know, furniture and televisions and things in their front yard that they were trying to sell because people just, you know, everybody was out of work and nobody had. And a lot of these factories where the factory owners had said, screw this, I'm going to go to China, the factory workers were still showing up, and they were taking over the factories. And now Argentina has a higher proportion of worker-owned businesses, you know, co-ops, basically, than most other countries. And some good stuff came out of that.
Okay, so, I mean, yeah, they went left. I mean, I don't want to say they went left completely, but they went left. And, I mean, the country right now, it's pretty bad. I mean, I'm sure you hear news about it. Everything over there, I'm not saying that the right is always right. I'm an independent thinker. You know, my dad taught me to be a critical thinker and to think for my own. And there's a lot of things that I agree with you. I like your show because you're a pretty fair guy. There's other things, you know, like, for example, like the gun issue here, it was a big problem here.
Yeah.
I saw gun control in Argentina take place, and I mean, I don't know if you know, but the crime over there, it's awful.
Well, it depends on where you are.
I'm not saying everybody should be armed. That's not what I'm saying by any means, but I don't know. I just feel like I'm starting to see a lot of this. I feel like I'm reading old news of my country here, you know, and it's odd.
Yeah.
It strikes me as odd.
Yeah, the corporations rising up and taking over. It wouldn't surprise me if we go through a crash not unlike Argentina went through in 2000. And you know, the question is what's going to come out of that. We went through a crash in the 1930s, and we went through that crash, and Germany went through that crash. I mean, the whole world went through that crash. And we had Franklin Roosevelt, and Germany had Adolf Hitler. And by the end of the 1930s, our two countries had gone in very, very different directions. So leadership really does mean a lot. And the will of the people means a lot, but leadership means a lot, too. And it's one of the reasons that I stay involved in politics, and I encourage people to get involved in politics, because I think that we've got some tough times coming, and we're going to have to make some really, really hard choices. And
definitely. Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
So we'll see where it goes, Marco. Thanks for the call. It's a thought-provoking topic. We should get a real Argentine or Argentine expert or Argentina expert on it. Talk about it. Donald in Aurora, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, Donald, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You know, I was listening to a guy, the gentleman that called up about the NSA, and he said, oh, when people found out, they were all enraged. What really gets me enraged, why aren't people finding out about what the Supreme Court did about literally rigging the voting elections again, that it's going to allow the southern states to have carte blanche to literally steal the election?
They're already doing that. North Carolina announced today that they're going to disenfranchise over 800,000 North Carolinians.
Yeah.
With a voter suppression law.
Nobody's protesting it. Nobody. I get.
Well, actually, in North Carolina, they are. Their Moral Monday protests are drawing thousands and thousands of people in Raleigh, and they're really starting to get some national attention.
Well, I hope it's nationwide, because you know what really kills me, too, people? We are a silly nation of people. A couple of days ago, the Hawks won over here in Illinois. Mm. They had a big party in Chicago. Over 2 million people showed up.
Wow.
2 million people. 2 million people showed up in a tiny little area. Why don't they do that in front of the Supreme Court and start protesting?
Well, in part because the Supreme Court has banned rallies and protests in front of the Supreme Court. They did this just a couple of months ago. Even though the First Amendment says that, you know, Congress shall make no law banning, you know, the people, peaceable assembly of the people and their right to peaceable assembly to redress, to petition their government for redress of grievances. The Supreme Court specifically said anybody who demonstrates outside the Supreme Court with a grievance, they use the word grievance, is in violation of the law and can get hauled off. So, it's weird. This court is weird. John Roberts is running a totally corporatist and therefore I would say fascist in the classic Mussolini meaning of the word. The merger of corporation and state, a fascist Supreme Court. Quarter two, 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
No, Hitler was not a fascist. He was a cult leader. He was a Nazi. He was a crazy. Mussolini was the fascist, and Franco in Spain. Jazz 2010 in the chat room says, of course, bugleweed. Why didn't I think of that? Is it true for dogs as well? Frankly, I don't know. Louise did the Googling on this. Oh, Louise is yelling from the other room. Yes, it is. Okay, but do not. We are not dispensing veterinary advice on this program. Now Louise is yelling no. Oh, she's saying look it up. Okay, I'm sorry. She's two rooms away and it's kind of hard to hear. She said, just, you know, plug it into the DuckDuckGo.com machine, and you can find out all about it. Bugleweed, hyperthyroidism, pets or cats or dogs or whatever. John, watching on TomHartman.com in Minneapolis. Hey, Tom, John, what's up?
Yeah, I just want, you know, you often, you know, have speeches from before Ronald Reagan, like from Roosevelt, Eisenhower. And I just was wondering, you know, I think there was such a tremendous change between, you know, in political idealism before Ronald Reagan and then how that, you know, ended up in such a materialistic, pragmatic kind of political philosophy that just basically revolves around how we can all make more money. And, you know, because I went to school between 74 and 80, and I mean, we were talking about ending poverty. The chairman of the sociology department was a Marxist. Almost everybody, you know, that I had as a professor were liberals, I mean, and very left of center liberals. It was really interesting how that changed, you know, so quickly. And I wonder if perhaps, because I had one professor who said that, you know, there is an ascendancy from the Southwest that
will pretty much take over our country politically. And he was talking about Ronald Reagan, Richard Nixon. And I think they came from a political culture that was very corrupt, very individualistic. You know, L.A., you seek your El Dorado, which, you know, basically you want to become rich and fast, you know. And that is really alien to the political culture of a lot of what is now called the blue states, which I think, you know, industrial culture that is more technological depends on cooperation. I mean, even though these are all, you know, we're a capitalist country, I mean, the evolution of unions and the evolution of the land-grant college system, how that all, you know, played into creating the industrial wealth of, say, like the Northeast and the upper Midwest is so different than the Southwest. And I lived in the Southwest for many years, and it's basically entertainment and the industrial military complex. I lived in New Mexico for years. I mean, I actually went to school with people whose birth certificates were officially falsified by the government because they grew up in Los Alamos.
Whoa.
And their parents worked at the lab.
Right.
It's just a whole different, I think it created a whole different culture, and we're living with the end result of that. And I don't think it's a positive thing. I really don't. I think that is a parasitic kind of relationship. There, states like New Mexico really have lived for years off of the wealth that has been created.
All of the red states, John, they are all takers, not makers. The red states take money from the federal government. The blue states give money to the federal government.
And now, you know, there is such a growth in the military, in the secret part of that, that's even more repulsive. And how we can, you know, get out of that, and how we can instill idealism in people. Because I talk to people, and it seems like some young people are very idealistic, but not like it was in your generation. And I lived in a, you know, I'm younger, so I you know, lived with some of that, but I thought I was looking forward to this wonderful future. We're going to solve poverty. What a wonderful thing. The war on poverty. They were still talking about that when I was in school and how we were going to get rid of it. And
Johnson actually cut poverty in half in 10 years.
Yeah. And, you know, and I think it was a good thing. And it has, it certainly has benefited other countries where they have been able to do that and provide, you know, almost free education and do all of these things. But, you know, somehow something just, you know, clicked in the American psyche. And, you know,
it wasn't just a click. It was marketed to us, John. Back in 1971, 72, Lewis Powell wrote a memo to his best friend, Eugene Sindor, I think his name was, who is the president of the Chamber of Commerce of the United States. And he said, we need to take over the schools. We need to, you know, the riff. And that memo became
about it. But yeah, actually, that's quite interesting.
Google Powell memo. And because Lewis Powell said, you know, we need to create think tanks to influence public opinion. And within a year, you had the Heritage Foundation and you had the Cato Institute, originally the Charles Koch Foundation. And you had, you know, a bunch of these think tanks
right.
created. He said the Chamber of Commerce has to get political. I mean, he was reacting to what he saw as an attack on business by the two of the best-selling authors of the 60s and early 70s, which were Rachel Carlson with Silent Spring and Ralph Nader with Unsafe at Any Speed. And he said we need to take over the colleges.
We have a political culture. I mean, I know you're from Michigan. I'm not from here, but this is very similar to the political culture that I grew up with without a lot of the corruption. I grew up in downstate New York and on Long Island. And, you know, what I see here is that there's an argument like, well, we've come this far and we've been quite successful doing this. We've created a lot of wealth here. We've translated the wealth that the old Yankees brought and you know, exploited through the railroads and et cetera, you know, the forests and then...
John, we have to wrap it up. You made a lot of really great points. Thanks for calling and doing so. Coming up tomorrow, we'll get an update on the Zimmerman trial from our legal expert, Debbie Hines from Legal Speaks. And special Anything Goes Wednesday. Plus, the best of the rest of the news and your calls. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. You heard David Cobb today on the program. Get over there to movetoamend.org. And while you're at it, check out Restore the Fourth, FOURTH.net. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.